Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. Our guest on this episode of Edgewise is Rick Merrifield. He spent nearly 15 years in various consulting roles, helping organizations define and achieve their goals. Since joining Microsoft, which is where he is right now, Merrifield has spent more than 10,000 hours as a business architect and has filed 12 patent applications, all with the goal of helping companies rethink their operating models and get out of the how trap described in the pages of his new book, Rethink. Rick, welcome to Edgewise.
Thanks, Dave. It's great to be here.
Rick, what's the biggest mistake companies are making right now as they cost cut in response to this current recession we're passing through?
I see two big mistakes. One is companies are aiming too low. We're really ending a 20-year period of constant growth where everybody's been just trying to keep up with the growth. And in a mode like that, what you see is people sort of excuse and expect and tolerate a certain level of waste. But over the course of 20 years, the magnitude of that waste is much bigger than people are expecting to find. And so instead of looking to find a little bit here and a little bit there, it's somewhere in the order of 20 to 40% of the operating budget in a lot of companies. And that's the attitude you have to have.
Yeah.
The second piece is, a lot of people think of cost-cutting and innovation as mutually exclusive, but a way to get the most dramatic cost-cutting comes through innovative methods. And we see some really interesting examples combining those two, especially now,
Right. Innovating
and cutting costs at the same time.
Well, that's the paradox of it. You're looking for innovative ways to cut costs versus phasing out your innovation efforts to cut costs.
Right. And innovation is a funny label because some people define innovation, if they define it as creativity, like lightning strike, they just hope it will happen and somebody will come up with a great idea. And other people see it as sort of a continuous improvement. It's not really on their to-do list on any given day, but they expect it to happen somewhere. And what I tell people is innovation is somewhere on the change spectrum of work. So when you have a problem or an opportunity, you say, is the right response to modify my scorecard a little bit to address that opportunity? Do I need to embark on a project to change it significantly, but it still resembles what was there before? Or in the case of innovation, what comes out doesn't resemble what was there before in the response to the problem or the opportunity. You should ask that question every time you have a problem or opportunity. Say, what is the right response? Innovation should always be on the table as a potential resolution or response to the opportunity or problem.
Right. We've achieved that evolutionary step in the corporate world, but we had to pass through a lot of other evolutionary steps where innovation was this gigantic hulking thing that became part of our re-engineering efforts, where armies of people were mobilized to break down processes and remap them and remove waste. Now, I think a more reasonable approach is it should be baked in. It's something you live with day to day.
Yes. And the other piece about innovation is some people think of it as it has to be something really big, the operating model. Like Netflix came up with a radically different operating model for renting movies, which is great. But if you look at just how we check in for flights today at the airport, pretty innovative now that it doesn't matter who's doing the work. Sometimes we, the customer, are doing the work. It used to only be the airline employee. It can happen anywhere. You could be at a hotel room on your phone, still at the airport. The process steps seem to be pretty variable. That doesn't seem to matter. And who knows what the technology is.
Right, right.
They realized that what they needed to accomplish, you're confirming a reservation, you're conducting a survey, and if you've got luggage, you've got logistics. And the airlines realized, yes, it has to be there. Yes, those steps have to be completed, but we don't care who does it, where it happens, or what the technology is. And in the midst of doing that, they increase customer satisfaction and cut costs through that innovative approach to pushing the work out to the customer.
In what ways can a rethink approach help turn this recession into a business opportunity that'll strengthen the long-term health of any company?
With companies having been in growth mode for so long and just trying to keep up, a lot of companies have really drifted into an operating model from where they originally started, and they were trying to be all things to all people, taking any customer they can get. Now, as we're retracting, companies really need to be very clear and specific about what value proposition they're creating and what customer they're connecting it with. So instead of being all things to all people, say, we're going to connect to this specific set of customers and probably turn our back on some customers because we can't afford to target all those different customers. So we're going to be very clear and explicit about price or quality or timeliness or whatever that customer segment values at whatever age or gender or wherever they are.
Sure.
And I think, honestly, that's part of what's been troubling GM recently.
Right.
They tried to be all things to all people in the process of not doing anybody any service. We see some brand new car companies, the Tata Motors Nano that they're selling for $2,000 is clearly a price product. And then we've got Tesla Motors has got the green car, the all-electric car. It's fairly expensive, but people are buying it. So very clear value proposition, clear demand. That's what people need to get in touch with right now.
But you don't just see that in car companies.
No.
All right, Rick, I have a question for you. What is what you call the how trap?
The how trap is, and it's taken me 6 years to come to this realization, but it's a completely human condition. It happens to all of us. A simple example that I like to use is if you've got a favorite restaurant or destination, the outcome of driving there is to get to that destination on time. That's what you're doing. But you tend to associate the route you usually take with the destination so much so that when somebody drives a different way, you say, well, why are we going this way? But it doesn't matter how you get there as long as you get there in the time frame that you're looking for. Same thing happens in the work environment where if you walk up to somebody sending a fax at the fax machine and say, what are you doing? They're probably going to say, I'm sending a fax. And if you follow a traditional line of questioning, if you're doing business requirements, whether it's a process reengineering or technology question, you say, oh, well, I'm not an expert in your business, but is that a necessary step in your process workflow for you to be successful in doing your job? And the person will say, yes, usually. So the person will mistakenly write down that the business requirement is sending a fax.
Right.
Whereas if you say, well, hang on, let's see, what you're actually doing is probably communicating status or confirming an order. How you're doing it today is with a fax machine. And that's a very non-confrontational way to engage the user. Mm-hmm. Even if you're not an expert in their business, you can have that conversation and you've disentangled the what and the how.
Okay.
The how in this case is a fax machine. So you can now test whether it's relevant, whether you can do email or automate or some other way to accomplish the outcome of the overall steps that this person is going through.
So focus on the what's and rethink the how's.
Correct.
What is this human impulse behind the how trap that we have to guard ourselves against?
There's a lot of discussion in the book about what how verbs look like and what verbs look like. So anytime you see something like fax or automate or truck or email, any kind of descriptive verbs, this is how I'm doing something. That's how verbs, mm-hmm. and just because we do things, we're repetitive, we attach them to what the work is. So it's difficult for us to imagine doing it differently, partly because we may be so busy, mm-hmm. we don't think it's worth our time to rethink it. But once you get this what lens on things, everything starts to become a what, and things really jump off the page to you.
Well, not only that, but in the majority of cases, there are metrics assigned to the how part of the question that people live and die with.
That's right.
The turnaround time to get from point A to point B.
That's right.
How much gas I'm burning at a stoplight, whatever the case might be, when the question shouldn't be so much the how, it should be the what.
Right. So a lot of scorecards are anchored to things like send a fax. So you've got probably not a bad metric attached to the wrong activity. So it's very fluid and it can change.
Good news, I sent out 6 faxes.
Right. Whereas the what's we found to be very durable.
Right.
So for example, the airport check-in, confirm reservation, conduct survey, and perform logistics happens in all 3 of the scenarios, whether you still go to the gate to talk to the airline employee, use the kiosk or over the web, all 3 of those things are still happening, but all of the hows are variable. So you have to measure each of them separately because each of them is doing something slightly different. And that helps to inform when you say, okay, there's a problem or an opportunity with how people are checking in for flights. Which of these 3 should we change, or do we need to add a 4th, mm-hmm. or what have you? It pervades your thinking once you make the separation between what and how, and that's all you see.
Exactly. Can you give an example from today's headlines about a company that perhaps got stuck in the how trap?
It's tempting to look at some of the financial services organizations. There are a lot of problems there. What strikes me as ironic is it's a math industry. Measuring risk is what those organizations do. And so for them to get into this much trouble in an industry, you have to be good at math.
Right.
There's some other behaviors there that are beyond the math.
Absolutely.
In the case of the auto manufacturers, mm-hmm. there's a level of complacency that they got to where they carved out some of their innovation budget and didn't realize that innovation was a necessary step along the way. They had to take some additional risk in how they make their profits. They were cutting the wrong things out to get to those profits, and then they basically have just run out of space to respond. And they've got these products that are fairly stale, that don't have explicit value proposition to customers, whether it's quality or price or being eco-friendly, and now they're stuck. And the amount of time and energy it's going to take to retool and say, well, are we going to be like Tata Motors Nano and have a $2,000 car? Are we going to be like the green cars? And there's several, like Tesla. Who's the new GM? The old GM is really a mess. And my guess is that something will emerge that will be a great brand again.
Sure.
But how these two brand new companies, Tata Motors and Tesla, can come up with a superior product and not have to look to someone like GM for best practices or something like that really tells me that something's more systemically broken at GM. They're making the inferior product at the inferior price point. They're much older and more established than either of these companies. There's something really wrong there. And I've wondered if we should be investing in those kinds of companies like the Teslas rather than trying to bail out the companies that are clearly failing. And people say, oh, we don't do that. That's not what happens in America. 2 years ago, I think we would have said $800 billion and get thrown at financial institutions.
Right,
we don't do that either, but we did it.
Yeah. Rick, it strikes me that you've got some really interesting perspectives on this whole thing. How did you acquire knowledge in this particular area? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
I came from a business consulting background to Microsoft. They had already created a big map of a hypothetical business. had about 1,000 activities on it. It's a 6-foot by 6-foot poster that started to ask these what, how questions.
Right.
The original goal was to get Microsoft in the business application software space. And Microsoft said, look, we don't know really what goes on in the business, and we don't really know what business software does. So they overlaid modules of then third-party software companies to inform an acquisition. We bought about 8 or 10 mm-hmm. companies that got us into the business software space. And they said, well, every time we have this discussion, this map seems to be different in some way that we don't really know.
Yeah.
I got brought in to figure out if there's something, if there's a method, there's a tool that's interesting to Microsoft or our customers in scale that can improve the discussion we have with the customers to help figure out where our products fit and where our products are the best fit. Mm-hmm. And that was basically the challenge. So I spent about a year looking at other models and methods and saying, okay, this is specifically different from these other methods and complementary to things like process reengineering and Six Sigma and Lean, went out and got the endorsement of most of the people who created those methods and went on a journey to test it to say, is it something that anybody can do? And that's part of what's been really exciting about this is a lot of these methods, you have to be a business guru and really know a lot about business. The how trap discussion where you push back on the person sending the facts, almost anybody can do that. It doesn't take that much training to say, this is a how verb and this is a what verb. And so you're using how verb to describe something. Let's try and put a what verb on it and see if we can disentangle those and maybe test whether the how can be different. And that's been the really rewarding thing for me is we've gotten it to be anybody can have the conversation. People are understanding the book and saying, I get it and I can start doing this tomorrow and this is great.
I think that's the key with so many of these things. A lot of these books and a lot of these theories and practices, unless you're an expert in a certain field, it's hard to get passionate about it. And I think what the business world is looking for is how can you make it real every day?
That's right.
And not only that, but how can you make it real to people who are not only leading people, but who are on the factory floor, who are working directly with customers?
Yep. In fact, there's a book website that I'll plug here. It's rethinkbook.com. And in the blog, I've started to frequently put what I call the how trap at home to say there are a lot of home situations where even in how traps. I did one over the weekend about parenting. There were a couple of articles in the Sunday New York Times about how parenting styles have changed. And recent years, people have been what they call helicoptering, where they cover every move their child makes. Sure. And don't let them make a mistake. And now the pendulum gone the other way where people just say, let them figure it out. So I asked the question, what is the goal of parenting? What kind of grown-ups do we want to raise our children to be? Do we want to have them be the kind of people who have to just figure stuff out on their own, or do we want to handhold them through every step of the way? And the question answers itself, but I think a lot of people are having that sort of discussion about parenting. That's one example of a how trap at home. So it's not limited to the workplace. It's just a different lens on how you test decisions that you make. And should I be specific?
Right.
You say, am I really clear about what outcome I'm trying to get to or not? And should I be specific? I often talk about Coca-Cola. They don't make anything anymore. They create intellectual property. Every one of their beverages, including Dasani water, starts as a powder, which they then sell to bottlers and distributors. They create intellectual property and they spend all their other money, the money they spend on branding and consumer marketing. And I will often ask in an audience, name another company that doesn't make anything, that just creates intellectual property and spends money on branding and marketing. Microsoft is a great example of that.
Of course.
The ability to pull away from some of these industry labels and expect to compare Coke and Pepsi, the reality is there are all kinds of best practices between Coca-Cola and Microsoft that we can compare to get all kinds of clever ideas, both for the intellectual property creation and the marketing that you wouldn't expect unless you'd pulled away some of these industry labels.
It might help for an organization, a corporation, a company, big or small, to start thinking of itself not as an elevator manufacturer or a motorcycle company or a soft drink manufacturer, or whatever, but as a knowledge company, as an information company. And really, when all is said and done, that's what you've got. Do you agree with that?
I do. In fact, the bookend example to Coke and Microsoft is if you look at Costco and Sam's Club, they're two companies that look very similar from the outside. What they do is pretty much identical. Sam's Club is a very traditional retail business. They care a lot about whose products are on their shelves. And so where they focus on how they do things is negotiating onerous supplier agreements. That's where they get the price point down so they can make profit off the products.
Yeah.
Costco doesn't make any money selling their products by choice. They don't care whose products are on their shelves. Their profits come from membership
dues. Membership dollars.
So they're a membership company, really, in a retail industry. That's what they're about. Somebody who compares Sam's Club to Costco is probably making a mistake because their operating models are so different, even though what they're doing is so similar. It's a question that I then will follow with the Newman's own organization, Paul Newman's initially salad dressing company. And I'll ask people how many people they think work there. And people will come up and say hundreds or thousands of people work there. When I visited them the first time 5 years ago, there were only 17 people in the company. And they were already a multi-$100 million company because Paul Newman didn't care about making products. He cared about quality recipes and he cared about giving money to charity. He didn't value anything else. So he outsourced the entire rest of the business to other organizations so that he could keep this really tiny company.
Sure.
And so I'll turn that around to an executive and say, are you as clear about what you value as Paul Newman was about what he and his organization valued?
It clarifies things, doesn't it?
It does.
We've been speaking to Rick Merrifield, author of the book Rethink. Rick, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Dave. It was a pleasure.
It would be great to hear your feedback on this program, so please drop us an email note at podcast@amanet.org or call us at 800-697-3406. That's 800-697-3406. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.